Hey, James, how are you today?
Good morning, Catherine. You know, as usual, I'm triggered because of you.
I'm so sorry. I know, I found this article. And,
if you were really sorry, you would stop doing this to me.
But you said you wanted, you know, I read all the time, and I just saw this article, and you know, your favorite media, the New York Times, and I had to share it. What do you want?
I don't know what it is about your ability to pick out things that will trigger me in on multiple levels, but surely there is some way that you can share things that won't trigger me. There are lots of things in the world that don't trigger me, that I don't immediately begin to hate and froth at the mouth at.
Oh, gosh. That's so funny. I didn't think this was triggering. At first, I thought it was more interesting than it was. And on rereading it, I decided I didn't even want to talk about it. But now it's so bad, I think we have to talk about it.
That's exactly the thought process I went through.
Okay. So see, we are on the same page on some things.
It looked interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I started reading it. And I was like, oh, this is terrible. Why am I reading this? And then I was kept reading it. It's like, oh, my God.
Right.
I can't not talk about this.
Right.
Because
okay.
Someone needs to. Someone needs to put these people in their place.
Oh, God.
Someone needs to continually dismantle the art world.
Dismantle it.
Yes.
Right. Well, I thought initially it was about recycling art. And it's,
yeah, well,
and
maybe you can throw out the title and get us started off.
Oh, right now?
We're talking about.
Okay.
I mean, because we're ranting about it. No one knows what we're ranting
okay,
about.
Okay. We're ranting about an article, folks, called Joining Plastic, Glass, and Metal on the Recycle List, Fake Art. And I thought they were recycling fake art. And that's not at all what it's about. We'll circle back to that later also, just
well,
to make the point.
Yeah, it makes a little bit of sense, but it's a very bad analogy. And also, they didn't use the, what's that called? Oh, the I think it's the Oxford comma. Whatever.
I know. I don't know. I probably suck at grammar, too. But, well, why don't you start us out, James? Talk about what triggered you initially.
The article is really about forgeries.
Yes,
and what
is.
Happens with forgeries. And they talked to this supposed expert, which we'll get back to.
Mm-hmm.
But the very first paragraph has this word that I've never seen before in my life called raisonné, or I don't even know how to pronounce it because it looks like it's probably French. I don't know. It's a catalog of work that you can use to create a style, kind of like a style guide for an artist or an author. And then you can use those criteria that you develop there to determine if a work is fake or a forgery or if it's authentic. So the raisonné, you don't have to just say catalog. You don't have to say that. You throw in these ridiculous words that nobody knows. You just sound like a dick when you use fancy words that nobody knows. Stop it. New York Times.
No, I think sometimes people forget to, maybe they think they're writing for their audience and it's supposed to be hoity-toity. I don't know.
They're
yeah,
just showing
up. I agree. It's, you know, and so many of these art articles, they do toss out terms that unless you were totally entrenched in the world or the, you know, their terms of art, so to speak.
Right.
You know, and just makes them sound important. It's one of those, to me, when I read, I read that also in the first paragraph. I didn't bother looking it up. I just blew through it. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's just that way to continue putting that arm's length between, like, the art world and the masses. You
it's
know,
not even necessarily the art world. It's just, quote, the elites. This is like the bad elites. These are the elites that people actually complain about.
Right. It's like, just, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like that, not a top tier, but it's just that segment.
It's using language as a weapon, as a way to distinguish their credentials.
Mm-hmm. I could sum this up in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
We can talk about it for like 20 minutes. I mean, I think it was overall a misleading title that led into a kind of boring article that led to nothing about recycling, which is what I was interested in. And then I was disappointed that they didn't destroy the fake art.
Most of it does not get destroyed.
Most of it does not get
and
destroyed.
And that's the only part of it that gets back to the idea of recycling because they just keep showing up over and over again. And everyone seems upset that there are forgeries in the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone seems upset that they keep coming up.
Right.
A simple way to deal with that is to destroy the work when that happens. Now, there are some good reasons to keep fakes. There are some of these collections where some of the museums and some of the colleges and universities actually have catalogs of fakes. And they use those to be able to show, basically teach students the difference between a fake and an authentic piece.
Mm-hmm.
But that also kind of gets the general point of what difference does it make if you like the piece, if the piece is a good piece, if it makes you feel something, if it has value, why does it matter who the author was?
Right. It's like, you know, they got really into the fraud. And that was, I think, one thing that I was thinking. It's like, I'm not into fraud. I don't like people lying on canvas or selling something for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars and pretending it's a...
Well, that's part of the art world, though.
I know
that's part of this tyranny of authorship. It's because this person touched this thing, because this person just because this one person made this thing, it's mm-hmm. automatically valuable, is a pretty dumb idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get the point that, you know, we have geniuses, they make things. Not everything that a genius makes, though, is going to be good.
Right.
Just like all my ideas are not good. I mean, I know it's hard for you to believe that, but I have a lot of ideas, and not all of them are genius.
A lot of them are.
But if the work is good on its own, why can't we just celebrate the work and not the author?
Right.
I think that's part of the reason the entire world, the art world, is skewed so badly, is because we make such a big deal out of, quote, superstars and celebrity. It's more about celebrity than about the work.
It is more about celebrity than about the work.
And as far as being, you know, concerned, about the forgeries, I mean, over and over again, this article explains why the forgeries, or talks about the forgeries not being destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Well, on one, they had a forgery stamp. It was a piece by a disputed Robert Motherwell elegy. And it just says, this painting is not an authentic work by Robert Motherwell, but a forgery.
Yeah, they did that on a Wyeth too, but he kept the piece. So
right, they keep the pieces, and they're hanging in their offices. There was even that one exhibit of all forgeries.
Yeah, and that, like I said, that's fine. There are some decent reasons to keep forgeries, but mm-hmm. this one guy that the FBI used as a source to determine whether it was a fake or not, mm-hmm. he actually wound up keeping the work, even though he puts on the back, it's a Wyeth in question, even though he writes on the back that it's a forgery, mm-hmm. that's not going to stop it from getting eventually back into the art world. You know, someone, right. after he's dead or something and his estate gets sold off, someone's going to find that, and they're either going to willingly or unwillingly resell it as a Wyeth, because who's going to look at the back? Yeah, at some point, someone might look at the back, but if they're really careful, they can paint over that or figure some way to abscond it or whatever.
Right.
Or just put in, this is not a forgery.
I know. I don't even know how you would do that. But, you know, go ahead.
So these people don't really seem that serious about forgeries.
I didn't think it's... Thanks for picking up on that, because I thought, am I reading something into this? Are they not caring? Are they not serious? Is this not a big deal? Because on one hand, they're like, it's fraud, it's all this stuff. And then it seemed like they were almost enjoying it.
No, it's hard to get that deep and to see what their emotional connection with,
I know.
It, with
I
that
just
is.
Had to go
but,
there.
Okay. but it also, it hints at... But doesn't really, it only hints at it. It talks, I think there's one sentence about it. These people who authenticate, the authenticators, the
yes.
people who authenticate whether it's a real Shili or not.
Right.
You know, that's just their opinion. That's not fact. Right. So you're taking the word of someone who claims to be an expert on these things, and it's just an opinion. So you could be making a multi-million dollar decision based on your opinion.
Right. Right. And unless you saw something in someone's studio, like as I reread the article again last night and wondered why the hell I ever wanted to discuss it. I thought, you know, unless you see something coming right out of someone's studio or you're watching them paint it and they hand it to you. I mean, how do you know who did it?
Well, there are ways to authenticate it. You okay. know, Banksy, as we've talked about in the past, actually put it on his Instagram feed if he was the originator of the work. And literally there have been cases where they will take photos of the artists in their studio. Mm-hmm. And show this piece is in the background. And that's another way to authenticate it. And I think that came up in a Pollock. And there was another, it was a Pollock case years ago about someone who basically found a Pollock at a thrift store or something like that, paid like $20 for it. And then there became this whole thing, is this a genuine Pollock? And if so, it's worth millions. Mm-hmm. And the guy who bought it was dead sure that it was a real Pollock. And some people were saying, yeah, it does look like a Pollock. And it may even have his thumbprint on it, though that was disputed. But then there was this one authenticator who was a complete asshole and just really condescending. It's absolutely not a Pollock. And for whatever reason, it was they went with his opinion.
Oh, wow.
And it was decided not to be a Pollock.
So they decided it wasn't a Pollock.
The general consensus that the last time I saw it was that it was not a Pollock. And okay. So it was only worth $20.
Okay.
But, you know, if it has the impression of a Pollock... This is just more ammunition to take down the art world. Doesn't this just show how sleazy the whole art market is? I mean, collectors, and because here's the other thing that they talk about is that they will, these authenticators say that they see the same pieces over and over again.
Yes.
because they keep getting sold. So the one collector will bring them a Wyeth that has been proven to be a forgery and say, no, this is a forgery. It goes away for a year, and another collector who has bought it and brings it back and says, no, same thing. This is a forgery. So the collectors are selling what they are known forgeries between each other.
That was surprising to me.
Yeah, it is pretty damn surprising that someone would, because that's fraud.
That is fraud.
And it just shows the lack of moral integrity throughout the collector market.
The collector market and the forgery market. I think what I was really struck with, and like in the middle, it's like that Damien Hirst piece. It looks like a little Mickey Mouse, the little circles. Yeah. I thought it was cute. It reminds me of it just looks like a little, I don't know. It just made me happy.
It's a deconstructed Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
I found it to be kind of tedious and obvious.
Yeah. Oh, but, of course it's tedious and obvious, but it's whimsical. And it just made me smile. And I was like, oh. And then the back of it, I mean, they had this whole ruse, like with the stamp and the print and the artist name and, you know, everything that would convey authenticity. And if you're a newbie collector, you know, they even have a picture of the stamp and it says Hearst and, you know, that's pretty intense. That's pretty fraudulent.
Yeah, but that's really low-hanging fruit, isn't it, to make a stamp?
Yeah, but I mean, so my question was, how does Damien Hirst protect his work better than this?
I think there are a lot of ways in making a crummy stamp, because this stamp is pretty crummy.
Yeah, the whole thing was pretty crummy.
And who cares if you're buying a Damien Hirst, you're not buying artwork in the first place. So I don't really care about those people.
Oh my God.
I mean, I don't know where he stamped the dead shark, but you have to inspect every dead shark you buy to see if it's got the actual stamp or not. I think he stamps them on the liver, but I could be wrong about that.
Oh, okay. I think you're right. I read something years ago about that.
Did you look at the stamp though?
I did.
Isn't that a terrible mark?
It is.
So the it's a circle. There's a black line around it, and he's got his name vertically and horizontally, and they intersect at the R. So there's only one R for Hirst in both directions. It just really looks bad. I mean, it's not like dirty or messy or anything. It's very precise, but it's just a terrible logo.
It's just kind of boring.
As a creative person, I'd be embarrassed to share that with people.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. Like the Maker's Mark. You know who was interesting? And this, I digress, but the interesting Maker's Marks are in Native American jewelry. Mm-hmm. They have some really interesting, they have really interesting Maker's Marks. I bought a piece accidentally at a thrift store.
Do you often accidentally buy things, Catherine?
It accidentally was worth something.
Oh, I see.
It's like I walked in, I'll just tell you real quick, because the Maker's Mark is what tipped it for me. But I walked into this thrift store that's now since closed, and I noticed the light like glinting off this silver belt. I'm not into bells. I'm not really into silver. But I thought that looks different. So I picked it up, and it was like some Cocopelli. It was like basically a pictorial belt of like a Hopi. It looked like the Hopi inlay. Not the inlay, but it's just I'm blocking on the term. Maybe I turned it over and I saw the Hopi Maker's Mark. And so I bought it. And it is worth significantly more than what I paid for it. I had it appraised.
Well, how much did you pay for it?
$12.
I'm trying to picture this. Is this some kind of, is it like a linked silver belt?
Yeah, I'll send you a picture of it. It's nothing I would be, you know, because when I shop, like I typically look for things that I can deconstruct and make something else out of. And so when I saw the links and I noticed that it was sterling, I'm like, oh, good. Hmm. You know, so I'm thinking like, is it melt value? What's the melt value? You know, it's like, you know what I'm saying? Because I have friends with big torches and we sometimes we've actually melted things and made ingots and then made other jewelry out of it. This is a work of art. I will not destroy this piece. It's just beautiful.
Right.
And what it is, it's nothing that I would ever wear, nothing that my aesthetic ever really drives to, but for what it is, I'm very appreciative of what it is.
All right, so that's interesting. You were drawn to it not for your own stylistic interests, but because you saw it as a genuine piece.
I just saw the light glinting off it, and I knew it was something different than all the other metal pieces that were hanging there. And
well, you know,
it sounds
like you could be an authenticator because you have the eye to see what's genuine.
Right. And so, maybe I could. That's I'm
yes,
looking for a job.
Not?
I'm looking for something to do with my time. But anyway, when you turn it over and then I searched on the Maker's Mark and it was readily findable. And I was just really struck. And so after I found who the artist was and could identify him, and he is still living, which was really interesting, really fun. But and no longer creating jewelry or anything at this point from my research. I just kind of perused the Native American makers' marks, and particularly the Hopis, and they're just interesting. They're little hogans, and there's trees. And I mean, it's really, and they've got it down. So yeah, the Damien Hirst, it was a little disappointing. Oh,
yeah.
Well, I mean, sorry, I digressed. Yeah, but so what else?
I kind of hinted at it earlier, but there are a couple of things. One of the things that made this article so bad was that they left a lot of unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm.
Questions
yes.
like basic questions. Once you start talking about art authenticators and you tell these stories about how the clients will bring a work to the authenticator, mm-hmm. and if the authenticator decides that it's not genuine and that it is in fact a forgery, mm-hmm. a lot of these works get abandoned, they mm-hmm. say. So they're just left with the authenticator. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's a woman by the name of Collar. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but something like that. So that begs the question, okay, if you know that you're an authenticator, you know a lot of these works are going to be left behind,
mm-hmm.
doesn't that give you some impetus or some drive to actually lie and say it's a fake when it's not a fake, and then to sell it on? And who's authenticating the authenticators? Who's keeping an eye on these people?
Ooh, that's an interesting quality check and balance. I didn't even see that in the article. Thanks for pointing that out. That's interesting. I read it.
Yeah, this is the idea. After I got through the arc, I'm like, I have all these questions that seem mm-hmm. like they're just basic parts of this story that no one's talking about. It's like, why are we trusting these authenticators? Is anyone authenticating these authenticators? How do you check up on it? Since it's largely based on opinion,
mm-hmm.
and you can get different opinions from different authenticators, you know, you can take it, you can have a whole ring of authenticators where one person will inauthenticate a work and then sell it to one of the other authenticators who will mm-hmm. then, you know, re-bless it and make it, yes, this is real. And they can have a whole black market going on here.
Oh, that's an ugly point.
Well, you know, I'm a bad person, so I think of all the bad thoughts.
Well, yeah, I wondered why they hung on to them, too.
If I were an authenticator, mm-hmm. I would think that you could at least explore the idea of having in your contract with the client, you say, if you bring me a work and I find that this is a forgery, I am obliged to destroy it.
Right.
Or you were obliged to, you know, to mark it and to also put it on some kind of registry so we know this is a fake. That seems like a real moral failing of these authenticators, that they don't have more responsibility to the art world and to the world in general to actually follow through with their findings.
That's interesting about a registry, particularly when it said that, like, the one at the very beginning of the article, they said that the one piece had been sold, like someone was assured that the piece was not real, and then it was sold to another collector, and then the collector brought it in and the authenticator said, I already saw this and it's not real. It just seems like they should be marked in some way, not with just some little thing in the back that could be painted over, or should be numbered, or you know, like when they herd up the cats in the neighborhoods and then they, like, mm-hmm. neuter them and do a little thing in their ear.
Maybe they nip their ears.
Yeah, they nip their ears. Maybe they should nip something in the painting.
Or just put on a registry. Create a registry. The FBI could have a visual registry of these pieces, you know, where they, you know, pictures of them and a description of the work and whatnot. It seems mm-hmm. like it's pretty low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I was disappointed.
Not discussing the article at all. Again, just, you know, if you're writing an article like this, think it through.
Mm-hmm.
Follow through.
And they're saying that the collectors actually don't want to announce to the world it's fake. And I get that. You don't want to be duped and spend a lot of money on something that's not what you thought it was.
You know, at some point, put your ego aside and just deal with the truth. That's not helpful to anybody.
No, it's not helpful. No, no.
Yeah, one of the authenticators said that she saw the same piece 10 times.
Yes.
I don't know if she's lying about that, but because that seems like a lot. But she said, you know, every year I would see the same piece come back. It's like, okay, aren't you going to do something to make sure that doesn't happen again?
That's what my question was too, James. Put a notch in it. You know, take a little.
And here's the thing.
What?
Maybe these people are doing the right thing in some way. Maybe mm-hmm. there is a registry, but the article doesn't talk about it. Just big questions left out in the air.
There could be a registry. We don't know that. You're right.
Do you want me to say something nice about the article?
Go for it.
This is the Times. This is the New York Times online edition. I think they have a splendid web design. I think their web design is the best news source web design that there is out there right now. This article, when you read it, the type is quite large, clear, and centered.
Mm-hmm.
So you can resize your browser. You don't have to even worry about where it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to be readable, to be
yes.
legible, to be easy to read. And the images, they have nice, big images.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really liked about the images is the subtext on the images. It's very clear, and it actually tells a lot of the story too. If you just read the images that go along with it, mm-hmm. If you just read the text that go along with the images, you can get a big part of the story, and all the images are credited too.
Mm-hmm.
So their web design is top notch. There's no gimmickry. There's no nonsense going on. They leave all that up to the writers. They leave the writers for the gimmicks and the nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But the design and the presentation is first rate.
Right.
Oh.
What?
Are you not going to talk about the bikinis?
What bikinis?
You said you read this piece twice and you forgot about... Well, maybe it's my male mindset, but I picked up on the bikinis. So one of the reasons they keep forgeries. The FBI has a whole list of forgeries that they actually keep.
Uh-huh.
And they reuse them for sting operations. And one sting operation, they were trying to catch a mobster. And so they had they said, this is, let me see if I can find the quote here. The script, so this is the script for the FBI agents when they're trying to get this mob, I can't remember if they're going, yeah, they're going for a mobster. The script called for Whitman, who is an FBI agent, to sell the work to a Colombian drug dealer on a yacht off the coast of Florida. The drug dealer, as well as the captain, steward, and five bikini-clad women on board were FBI agents. So the sale was completed with fake diamonds and a supposed bank transfer, but the mobster eventually disappeared. And the setup was they initially met the mobster in a Miami home that was decorated with the fakes that they had. But here's the question:
mm-hmm.
So as a taxpayer, am I paying for bikinis? And am I buying bikinis for FBI agents?
Probably.
Oh, that's crazy. That's fine. But
I see that
crazy.
Now. That is crazy. Well, I guess it would be a good reason because you wouldn't want to put the real works of art, I suppose, through.
Well, they don't have them.
Yeah.
Why would the FBI have a Chagall?
Right. But so I guess there is a use for it. And speaking of Chagall, like when you looked at that piece, did you look at that Chagall?
I did. It was terrible. We'll have a link in the show notes to the article that we were talking about so you can see this. They have, in this show, they had the original Chagall next to a copy, a forgery of the Chagall.
They're both forgeries.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
No, they're not.
Marc Chagall did paint a work known as Le Nappe, but this forgery confiscated by the FBI was later shown and was not it. And then it says slightly different, but no less fake. This copy of the Chagall work was also seized by the FBI as part of.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought the one on the left was authentic.
I thought they were too initially, and they're both fakes.
I'm glad you caught that because I didn't. But I was going to say that the one on the left looked better than the one on the right. Like clearly, the one on the left is more Chagall-y than the one on the right.
True. Because I was fooled at first, and then I'm like, but there was something missing.
Well, the one on the left doesn't look, it looks a little bit muddy, so I was like, okay, that looks more like a Chagall, but it ain't. But then the one on the right just seemed a little bit too slapdash, and what's the word? It doesn't look very good. It doesn't look like a good painting. Neither of these really look like a good painting, but the one on the left does definitely reads as more Chagall-ish.
It does, Chagall-like, yes. Agree. And that's the one I thought was real. But I felt like there was something off with it. And then I finally read the text underneath. And I'm like, okay. I felt affirmed in my ability to see work.
Yeah. So you're an authenticator.
You know, and I'm like, there's something off about both of these. And I just didn't get any vibe. And I've never been a huge Chagall fan. I'm appreciative of the work, but I'm not a huge fan.
Yeah, it's the same here.
And the one on the bottom, you know, like yours are left and right. I guess the one on the right looks like something I would do if I was trying to do like some abstract flowers. I think I've actually created things that probably look somewhat like this. And so,
well, that's the case. I would say you need to work more on your painting skills.
Yeah. Oh, clearly. Clearly. That's not even a question, James.
Why are you podcasting? Just go practice your painting.
I need to practice something here. So that's the article. I was disappointed. I really wanted them to talk about like repurposing the canvases into like usable handbags or, you know, like gessoing them over and giving them to art students or cutting them up and making a collage of the face of the master that was, you know, being ripped off by the forgery. Wouldn't that be fun? Take the forgery.
This is crazy. Who the hell are we? And yet we're coming up with great ideas that these people aren't. I mean, they're just going through their day doing the same old without, you know, just letting these forgeries, basically a revolving door of forgeries where they just let them back out in the world. And you coming up with these great ideas on how to actually deal with them.
Wouldn't it be fun, though, to get a bunch of them and just like make a collage of a face of like Marc Chagall out of a fake Chagall?
When I become emperor of the world, I will put you in charge of the Department of Forgeries.
Okay, good, good. And I'll make handbags and stuff.
You also assign an armed detachment to your office.
Okay, why?
So you can, I want you to be armed so you can go in and claim these pieces and, so you don't get any back talk from the people.
Armed. I know. What if I cut up a real Chagall?
Yeah. Is that really the worst thing in the world?
I don't know if any of this is the worst thing in the world.
Hey, you know, if Catherine doesn't like it, it doesn't deserve to exist.
That would be my authentication stamp.
There you go. Catherine approves.
Approved.
I think the last detail that I thought was really weird about this, that one of the authenticators that they were talking about was a caller.
Mm-hmm.
So her specialty, apparently she specializes in two artists. One is Egon Schiele. Do you know Egon?
No.
Oh, he's a, late 19th century, early expressionist painter.
Okay.
Or I could be getting my dates wrong. Maybe he's early 20th century. No, I'm going to say late 19th century. Austrian or French or German or something, European. Mm-hmm. I actually love his work. He's a little weird, though. I think he died of syphilis or something like that.
Ah.
But he's very distinct. He's got very distinct work. It is not at all. Do you know Grandma Moses?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Of course you know Grandma Moses.
Of course. I mean.
Well, I wouldn't say these are polar opposites, but they're not exactly on the same level. They're really very different kinds of people. And those are the two artists that she specializes in, Schiele and Grandma Moses. That doesn't make sense to me, but okay. I don't know. I guess I just never really paid much attention to Grandma.
Right.
But I looked at some of her works as a follow-up to this because I was curious, and I kind of like them.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to look it up.
What I don't like about it is she's called, quote, a folk artist, which is nonsense. I mean, that's a stupid term. Either you're a painter or you're not a painter. It doesn't matter if you were classically trained or not.
That's a term that triggers you, James. You've always been triggered.
Is.
You've always look.
It's just marketing. It's just purely for marketing reasons. There's no reason. Why would I take anyone more seriously because they went to some school or another school or did something? It's all based on the work. If you're able to make a great movie, who cares what school you went to?
Right. I love her stuff. I love her stuff. I'm looking at some of it now.
And I think it belies her talent because firstly, I look at her work and I see a pretty masterful abstractionist. Mm-hmm. This is abstract work. And to try to belittle it by just calling it folk art, I think misses the point of what the genius is in the work. Sure, some of it's simplistic, but there's a lot of very complex depth and flattening, and there's a lot of complexity to these works.
Mm-hmm.
These works in the level of abstraction that's going on. And I was thinking, this is, as I said, it's a really good example of abstraction. Mm-hmm. She's telling a story on the canvas, and it's a little bit like Norman Rockwell, but. Not. I got kind of a Rockwell sense for it because it's grabbing a scene of America and showing it to you.
Right. It's a very almost naive Rockwell.
It's just encapsulated. It's an encapsulated scene of a particular time and place in history. It's a completely different kind of piece. And I was thinking, if Basquiat was going to paint an America,
yes.
And tried to do a Rockwell, I think this is what a Rockwellian Basquiat would look like.
Oh, you think?
No, I just thought that was a weird thing to say, so I thought I'd say it. Plus, it strikes me as Basquiat. I think Basquiat and Rockwell are spirit animals. Guide us. Animals.
Yeah, they might be. Yeah.
Humans are animals, so it's not like I'm denigrating them in any way.
Spirit artists. No, her work reminds me, there was years and years ago, it was one of my favorite. When I was in college, I worked in the China department of one of the major department stores here in Phoenix. And Villeroy & Bock had a pattern of stoneware, it was China or something, like dinnerware, that was called NAIF, N-A-I-F. And there were similar images to Grandma Moses.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're adorable. I purchased one piece. I couldn't afford it. I was in college, and I still have the little NAIF.
No, you should have just stolen it.
No. I couldn't do. Are you kidding me? No, but I just bought a little covered dish for.
Yes, I'm
kidding
you. Obviously.
But that's what it reminds me of. So I think it's, and the term folk art never triggered me until you started having it trigger me. Feels like a derogatory term now. Although I used to really like the term.
Only because it's purely marketing. It's just purely marketing.
What do you think they mean by that term?
They're trying to get you to look at it in a different light. They're trying to make it look like it's something different and unique from the art world. It's not. They're trying to create these categories so that they can sell differently in different people. It's trying to find a different market. It's like, why does GM have all those different brands? It's exactly the same reason. They have one car that they sell through three different brands.
Mm-hmm.
With three different names and three different bodies, but it's all the same car underneath. It's exactly the same idea. This is, you know, this part of the art world won't respond to a Pollock, but if we say it's an untrained artist, they will respond to that instead.
So is that a way to elevate then untrained artists to make them feel or elevate someone whose talent is not up to the standards of, say, like a Rockwell or Basquiat or Picasso?
Only in a marketing sense.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't do anything academically. Again, the work stands on its own, okay. Not from the backstory, but because the work itself doesn't right. have any value. And either it does or it doesn't. And you don't have to have training to make great work. When I don't know how many people you need to have as examples of that.
Right.
And, you know, once you start working and start making paintings, it's kind of hard not to get educated. As a gallerist, former gallerist, I had a woman I used to represent whose work was interesting. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed representing her. She claimed to be a folk artist, but she may not have gone to school trained as an artist, mm-hmm. but she was a very well-educated woman. Mm-hmm. And she worked in creative fields, different kinds of creative fields. And to try to portray her as a folk artist was really disingenuous.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just because she wasn't trained, she was quite well-rounded, quite intelligent, and not, quote, a folk artist.
Okay. Folk art to me encompassed so much more than just something on canvas. Like folk art to me, before I started delving into it, I just would always think of like Amish dolls or someone who was woodworking or quilt making. You know, any of that, what the high art world would consider like super low rung or almost gravitating toward craftsmanship.
If you really put that together, then you're denigrating the work because it's not, quote, on the same level. We're still looking at this, even though it's not a great Rembrandt or something like that. So I think it can be used as a derogatory term.
Right.
And I think subconsciously, in some ways, it is.
I think it is. I think it's kind of a derogatory term.
Which is stupid, because if you look at woodworking or you look at quilts, there are some magnificent quilts in the world. But a lot of the quilts that are beautifully made, they don't have to be art. They can be high craft. This idea that craft in and of itself isn't a valuable thing that we should cherish is stupid.
Mm-hmm. It is stupid. And as someone who probably dabbles more in craft than in quote-unquote art, you know, I see that continuum all the time. And I use a lot of fibers, almost like mm-hmm. I would use paint. And to be honest with you, the more I work with strings or different kinds of, you know, linens or I don't know, I enjoy it more than painting because I feel like I've learned to manipulate it differently mm-hmm. over the years. And it's like I'm painting with fibers.
Yeah, it sounds like you've been drawn to a new medium for you.
Right, for me. Yeah, for me. But that would never be seen as serious work.
Well, it depends on who's looking at it.
Yeah, right, depends on who's looking at it. And I don't know why I would need that affirmation. I don't, you know.
Oh, affirmation's great.
Affirmation is great, yeah. So we digress. But, you know, in terms of the forgeries, you know, like you said, if the work stands on its own, and those Chagalls did not move me. Not that I'm ever moved by Chagall to an extent that I would be by other pieces, but I just knew there was something wrong. And it's just like, why don't you do something with it? You know, I think I'm just coming back to that because I like using recycled pieces in my work. I like recycling stuff.
So what's our goal for next week? To make forgeries?
I don't know. I don't think I could do it. I could maybe knock out a Chagall or two.
Yeah. I think I could knock out a Basquiat or two.
Yeah, you might be able to do a Hearst.
I'll do in my sleep. Well, I don't even have to do that. I can just go buy a Twister map. Mat, I guess. It's not a map.
Okay.
All right. This was an angry podcast, I think.
You think it was angry?
I felt angry.
You felt angry. I felt
mostly it wasn't at you, which was different.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
I felt like we were angry together at the same thing.
Oh, I just was irritated because I wanted to talk about stuff like on the level of Louise Neville or something where they're grabbing crap, you know, off the streets of New York and painting it gold. And now it sits in museums everywhere. And
should we talk about her next week?
Yeah, let's talk about her next week.
Oh, boy. Okay.
There were some other articles that I was perusing on recycled art. And I do think that, you know, since our planet is dying, maybe it's not a bad idea. Well, James, this was an interesting discussion.
Thank you for triggering me again.
Okay, I'll continue to try. Give me a minute, and I'll send you some more articles this week.
Oh, goody.
Okay.
I still look forward to that, and so does my blood pressure.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.